Welcome to ITE 1, Semester 2, Module 5, Part 1. This module has never gone in a single part, and I don't want it to. There's so much stuff in here, and I want to make sure that you guys get time to understand it as well as possible. And I understand some of you guys have read the chapter, and that is beautiful. Are there any questions on labs? Outstanding issues, anything that you guys have before we get started?
You have been moved to the lecture
Hello.
Theater.
We will. I don't recognize you, but I believe we can show you how to make it to the lecture theater in a moment. Anybody have any questions on anything? Okay, I am guessing that we don't.
A question, Sean?
Yes, go ahead.
It's Corey. I was wondering, there seems to be in Chapter 5 a whole bunch of labs. Do you just pick the one that's most suited for your operating system?
You pick an operating system that you have access to, and you do the labs for it. Module 5 is a great time to look at virtual machines, and I encourage any of you who want to do these labs but are afraid to break your own computer, you can get a virtual machine of Windows XP Pro and use it, break it as much as you want, unzip it again, and you get the machine just the way it was when you downloaded it. We have a CaviCast that explains about that that was done last term. Okay, so for the last few weeks, we have mainly been talking about the hardware of the computer, but today we're going to be discussing a computer's most important piece of software, and that's the operating system, or OS, and it controls almost all computer functions. The curriculum discusses Windows 2000, XP, and Vista, and the very latest Microsoft OS, which is Windows 7. All operating systems are responsible for four basic tasks, which we'll talk about in detail. They are: control hardware access, manage files and folders, provide a user interface, and manage applications. Operating systems are the middleman between applications and hardware. A driver is a small program installed with each hardware device that allows the operating system to recognize, assign resources to, and allow applications to use hardware. These drivers are created by the device manufacturer and found on CDs that come with the product, manufacturers' websites, and Windows updates. Some drivers Windows has itself, but manufacturers' drivers are usually good. The best place to find the latest drivers is the manufacturer's website of the device you're talking about. The plug-and-play, otherwise known as PNP, process was introduced in Windows 95. This allows devices to be detected, drivers to be installed, and resources assigned automatically when it works. That's the part that I'm adding in, because it doesn't always. The operating system then configures the device and updates the registry, which is a database that contains all of the information about the computer, and we'll come back to that. Actually, there's a little bit more about it. The registry contains information about applications, users, hardware, network settings, and file types. We'll talk a little bit more about that later, and we did a podcast about it last week,
which is going to go up today. It was very good, actually, for anybody who was there.
It was good. Awesome. I had to listen to it again, even though I was there. Next, we will talk about file management. The operating system creates a file structure on the hard disk drive to allow data to be stored. So a file is a block of related data that is given a single name and treated as a single unit. Myfile.txt is a file all on its own. That kind of thing. Files are stored in directories so that they can be found easily. Directories can have other directories inside of them called subdirectories. These terms are more used in DOS and I believe other command line. I believe Unix likes the term directory. In Windows, these are called folders and subfolders. Those are the ones inside of folders. Here is an example. The C drive is usually the main drive for Windows machines. And when we talk about drives with letters, they're C colon, A colon, D colon, and so on. They have a colon after them. Your C drive is the root of your file system, which means it is the highest level folder. So everything comes off the C drive. And then program files is a subfolder within the C drive that contains files and folders for the applications installed on your computer. Hello. The third function an operating system performs is providing a user interface. So your computer would not do you a lot of good if you could not use your hardware and applications. You'd basically have a very expensive paperweight. So the operating system is what lets you get anything done on a computer. The user interface allows you to interact with your computer, as I said. There are two types of user interfaces. These are important to know, and you'll learn them eventually if you're not familiar already. Command line interface, CLI, allows you to type commands at the command prompt. A graphical user interface, GUI, or GUI, allows you to interact with menus, icons, and other various graphical elements using a keyboard or mouse. Windows operating systems include both. You guys get to do a cool lab that demonstrates the two user interfaces in this module. And the command line one is pretty cool if you're not used to how the command line works. The last of the four basic functions is application management. So, guys, let's name some applications. What are some applications that we know about?
Internet Explorer.
Yep.
Microsoft Word.
Absolutely.
Jaws for Windows.
Oh, you guys said that at the same time.
That was awesome. That was almost Jaws perfectly lined up.
Sounded like an echo.
Okay, with Excel and PowerPoint.
Yep, and even Ventrilo, which we're using right now. So all of these are programs that you can run. There are two ways to open. Notepad is another application, and there's two ways you can open it. And you can open it by clicking its icon in the Start menu under Programs and Accessories, or typing in Notepad into the Run dialog box or the search box in Vista and 7 in the Start menu. The application is loaded into RAM by the computer when you open it in any of the ways just described. Does anyone remember what RAM stands for?
Random access memory.
Absolutely, random access memory. That is correct. The operating system also makes sure that the application has enough resources to run. This is in your test. An application programming interface, or API, is a set of guidelines used by programmers to ensure that the applications they are developing are compatible with an operating system. I'm going to briefly fix that. Two examples of APIs are OpenGL and DirectX. Can anyone name something else that they have heard of that's an API?
The speech thing, which now I just forgot.
SAPI.
Microsoft Accessibility is right. SAPI is right. Speech API.
Hey, here's a big one. Twitter's got one.
4 and 5. Yeah, Twitter's got one.
Actually, so has Twitter, but yeah, you're right. Twitter's got an API.
Yep, Twitter's got one, and there's other services.
YouTube.
Foursquare's got one, I think. Yep. I believe YouTube has one.
Yeah, because you're able to access YouTube in like places like Klango, or you can access YouTube on your
course.
You have an app, you know, on your
phone. Yeah, of course. I should have thought of that. Know. Cool. All right. So we've got APIs. In order to be able to compare the features of an operating system, it's important to understand some basic terms. So here are some basic terms. Multi-user. Two or more users can work with programs and share peripheral devices, such as printers, at the same time. Multitasking. The computer is capable of operating multiple applications at the same time. Does anyone know what multiprocessing might mean?
Pushback!
More than one processor?
Yes, more than one central processing unit itself on the board that programs can share. What about multi-threading? Okay, that's a tough one. Multi-threading, it means that a program can be broken into smaller parts that can be loaded as needed by the operating system and executed. So that's a tougher one, but that's okay. Most modern operating systems... Go ahead.
Sorry, is multiprocessing, is that like dual core? Or does it have to be two separate?
Multiprocessing means your operating system can access two or more processor chips on the same motherboard. Okay, sorry, I've just gotten some hair pinched in my headset. I apologize for the movement.
Multi-threading means that multi-threading is when a program is actually split into discrete execution threads. So one thread could be updating the screen, and the other one could be playing the audio, and the other one could be accepting keyboard input. So that's what multi-threading means.
Most modern operating systems support all of these. I believe someone's constantly keyed.
No one is.
All modern CPUs can run in different modes of operation. The mode of operation determines how the CPU manages applications and memory. The four common modes of operation are in your test. They are real mode, protected mode, virtual real mode, and compatibility mode. Now, I disagree with compatibility mode being a CPU mode. I think that's something that the operating system itself handles, but the test is going to refer to it this way, so this is another instance of Cisco thinks it's this way, so it is so. Here's how those work. When a CPU operates in real mode, it can only run one application at a time and has access to only 1 megabyte of memory. Although all CPUs are capable of real mode, only DOS or Windows 3X and their 16-bit applications use this mode. Real mode provides applications with direct access to system resources, all of them. So why might this be a problem?
You won't be able to multitask.
Absolutely. And if a program crashes, it crashes the whole computer. All at once. In protected mode, applications are protected from using memory currently in use by other programs. This allows multiple programs to run at once. In protected mode, the CPU has access to all of the computer's available memory, including virtual memory. Can someone define virtual memory for me?
Is it
virtual
memory that
kind
of acts like RAM?
On the disk. Yeah.
Absolutely.
It's memory that's actually on disk.
That's right, and emulates RAM. Okay, we're going to have to do type your name into chat. Just so that things get a little less confusing. Sorry about that. So next time I'll have you do that. Protected mode provides 32-bit access to memory drivers and transfers between input and output I/O devices. This is the mode of operation for modern operating systems. Virtual real mode allows an application that would operate in 16-bit real mode to operate in protected 32-bit mode. So this would allow a DOS application to work in Windows XP, for example. So it gives the program the illusion of running in real mode, but it's actually protected that part that is protected from the rest of the computer. Now, compatibility mode allows applications that are not compatible with a newer operating system to function by providing the environment of an older OS. So it basically fools the program into thinking that it's using the older operating system. So if you're working in Windows 7 and that game that you loved so much in XP doesn't work, try running it in compatibility mode, because even though you have no guarantees, it just might work. The text says that Vista is very compatible with older applications, and as Grace puts it, quite honestly, for all the bad things you could say about Vista, she actually tends to agree with them that for more older applications would work than didn't, and I don't know how true that is of 7, but that's an area where Grace tends to agree, and I actually don't have any experience really with Windows Vista, so you'll have to ask her that if you are wondering why, because I don't know.
What's the problem with Vista? I've had some experience with Windows Vista.
She was saying that the text says that Vista is pretty compatible with older applications, and she said as much bad as you could say about Vista, she tended to agree that older stuff did
work. You can run a lot of the older stuff under Vista, and they just ditch the compatibility options for Vista were better. They've ditched a lot of the backwards compatible legacy stuff in 7. Vista was good once you applied Service Pack 1. Well, no, Sean. We don't want to be stuck in 1984 playing Digger.
True.
Come on. I mean, you know, the Mac ditched all its compatibility stuff and it got infinitely better, which is why they didn't go bankrupt.
That's true. Okay, now the text talks about there are two useful compatibility features that Vista provides, and I imagine 7 may be similar, but here we go. The first feature is Windows XP Service Pack 2, SP2, compatibility mode. This allows applications that are not compatible with Windows Vista to be executed as if the operating system were Windows XP SP2. The second feature is a method to override the user account control, or UAC, which we'll talk about a little bit later. This allows an application to be run even if the user does not have the required administrative privileges. This is the Run as Administrator checkbox. In Windows 7, you can adjust the level of monitoring for UAC. When Windows 7 is installed, the default setting is 33% on the slider, which is notify me only when programs try to make changes to my computer. To adjust the level of UAC, you can type UAC in the search box in the start menu, or go to Start Control Panel, User Accounts and Family Safety, User Accounts, and change User Account Control Settings. The control panel in Windows 7 has... Actually, let's go back a moment. User account control is that thing that says something wants to change. Do you want to allow or deny? And that thing that people kind of hated and made fun of about in Vista. In 7, on that default setting, it's a lot better. And for users who aren't as comfortable on the computer, I think it can be helpful. If you feel comfortable on the computer and you feel like I want to change things when I want to, turning it off will basically make your life a whole lot easier.
There's actually some advice from the screen reader manufacturers that say no, you should not be encouraging blind people to turn off UAC because it does alert them to things that they otherwise wouldn't be aware of. So there are two sort of schools of thought on that. I turn mine off, but there is actually an argument for leaving it on because sometimes things will do things that you don't expect, and without UAC you'll never know about it.
If you really don't want Java to update...
Could you give an example of that, please?
Okay, say for example you insert a thumb drive and it goes, "Burr! This program is trying to run software on your computer," and you go, "Hoi, I almost got virused. No."
Okay.
So that's kind of how user account control works. You need to make sure that your screen, it won't work if you're using like NVDA from a portable distribution. Your screen reader needs to be fully installed. in order for that to work, because it's a secure desktop. Now, talking about the control panel, in Windows 7 there are three view options: category, large icons, and small icons. You can assume that we'll be using category view in the course. The icons view can be easier, and if you want to switch to it, you tab around until you get to the search box, or you can press Control E to get there. Tab once until it will say category button, press space, and then choose either the icon view options. And the links will appear in columns and rows, and you do have to go up, down, left, right, but it does make it a lot easier to know what the utilities actually are. You know, you see Credential Manager and you go, oh, that's what that is. Instead of it sort of hiding behind a link. You still get links inside the options, but I like that and I find it easier. If a program does not work in Windows 7 and it worked in earlier operating systems, use the compatibility troubleshooter or set compatibility settings manually. To troubleshoot program compatibility in Windows 7, I've actually never done it this way. Follow these steps. We're going to go through it anyway. Click Start Control Panel. In the search box, type Troubleshooter and click Troubleshooting in the list displayed. Under Programs, click Run Programs Made for Previous Versions of Windows and click Next. Window searches for compatibility issues. Hang on just a moment. Okay, sorry about that. Let me go back. I had an interruption. Windows searches for compatibility issues and a list of programs is displayed. Select the program you are having problems with and click Next. If the program is not listed, select Not Listed, choose Next, and then Browse so that you can locate the program, and then choose Open, Next, and then click Next. You can choose Try Recommended Settings to run the program using the settings that Windows 7 has determined to be the most compatible, or you can also choose Troubleshoot Program, which allows you to select troubleshooting steps based on the problems that you've noticed. And you can click Start the program to see if the problem is solved. And then you click Next to apply the settings permanently, or repeat the process to choose different settings until compatibility is reached. That's kind of interesting. I've never done it that way. Here's the way I've done it. You can also run the program compatibility troubleshooter by right-clicking the program shortcut or icon and then choosing Troubleshoot Compatibility. Oh, now I've done it using the properties of the programmer shortcut, where you can specifically say, hey, I want you to play with as if you're Windows XP. So there's a couple different ways to do that. Any questions so far?
Has anyone seen Ali?
No, I haven't. I think someone is constantly keyed.
I have a question on... I typed my name, but man, you didn't see it. But if I may... okay, the
Let me see.
Run as administrator option is... That has me a little bit confused because, I mean, I think of there being a couple reasons why someone would have a user account as opposed to an administrator account. One is to avoid someone from outside who has somehow gotten into your system taking serious control because they have those privileges. And I understand that would be blocked by run as administrator, but also it's because the real administrator doesn't want you messing with things. So is that something that is easily switched on and off by the administrator, the run as administrator option that was referred to just a minute or two back?
Did he refer to it?
I believe so. Yeah, it did.
Yeah,
It did talk about that option. I think the idea with that option is that some XP programs basically assumed that you had administrative privileges to do anything. There were some games programs that you'd go to install or run them, and they would say, I have to be administrator. And this is a way of fooling that program into thinking that it is, and so that it can actually work. Some programs did not being the administrator.
Yeah, there are two different runners at administrator options. One actually runs the program as administrator, which is the actual run as administrator from the right, from the context menu of the program shortcut, or the one that you get by pressing Control Enter on a program. Is it Control Enter or Shift Enter? I can't remember. That actually runs. It actually runs the program as administrator. The one in Compatibility Center just pretends it does and tries to give the program access to as much as it can without actually giving it administrative privileges. Basically, when Microsoft released Windows XP, they told everybody that you could do everything with a limited user account, but you so couldn't, and it all blew up. And then when Vista and 7 came out, they kind of fixed it, but it took a while for the program vendors to catch up, and it still isn't all fixed. So that's the reason behind. See, technically, you shouldn't run as an administrator all the time. I don't know how many people run as regular user accounts. I certainly don't.
So okay, now we're going to compare...
I still have one little question, if I may, on that then. So the real, quote-unquote, real run as administrator option, that, I assume, is something that an administrator can disable for a specific account, or am I wrong about that?
Of course they can. We can stop you from accessing your desktop with a policy editor if we want to. We can stop you from pulling up the run box.
Right, okay, but I mean, is it a fairly standard option, or is that something that... I don't know. I don't know enough to.
There is no easy. There's no easy checkbox that says stop my computer from doing stuff that would possibly break it. That's what UAC is for. But there is no easy checkbox. You do it with a group policy editor, and you only do it with versions of Windows that are above. Home Premium won't do it. You need Professional or Enterprise to have the policy editor. Otherwise, you're hacking the registry.
Okay. That pretty well answers it. Thanks.
Now we're going to compare. If nobody else has any other questions, we're going to talk about 32 and 64-bit operating systems here. There are three main differences between 32 and 64-bit OSs. 32-bit operating systems can only use about 4 gigabytes of memory, while 64-bit systems can use more than 128 gigs. RAM is managed differently in 64-bit operating systems, which allows for better performance of 64-bit programs. Here's something that can be considered a downside when we talk about this. A 64-bit operating system has additional security features such as kernel patch protection and mandatory driver signing. And the driver signing one is the big issue because not everything that will work if there's no 64-bit drivers for it.
Here's a thought.
The kernel patch protection, yes.
This is why a certain highly popular accessibility product is not enabled for people who cannot afford it in a 64-bit operating system.
That is true. With kernel patch protection, third-party drivers cannot modify the kernel. With mandatory driver signing, unsigned drivers cannot be used. Can anyone name any 64-bit operating systems?
Windows 7?
Yeah, Windows 7, anything above starter can be. What else?
Mac OS 10.
The recent Vista. Releases of Mac?
That's correct.
Kind of. OS X is a funny one. The user land is 64-bit, but the kernel by default is 32-bit. So, I don't
How
know
does that work?
Well, it does. You actually have to officially... I don't know whether that's changed in Lion, but as of Snow Leopard, the user land is 64-bit and the kernel is 32-bit, and you actually have to do a fiddle to make both go into 64-bit
at the really risk want of possibly breaking kernel, older software. You hold down 6 and 4 while you start up, apparently. Now, in Lion,
how do you
they probably
keep it that
just
way?
Said 64. I don't know. I think if you'd want it, you'd have to Google if you really wanted to do that.
That's like, no, I'll just ask Kieran. It's fun.
Or you can do that. Okay, so, yeah, so there's Windows XP 64-bit and the Windows Vista 64-bit, things like that. Now, if you are wanting a particular one, let's say you want 32-bit and you know you want 32-bit and you're buying a brand new computer, find out what's on it before you get started. If you know you want 32-bit and your computer has 64, it's probably a good idea to know that right away. If you now you could put a 32-bit version of an operating system on it if you choose to. Now, this isn't as big a problem as it used to be when, for quite some time, the 64-bit version of JAWS hadn't been out yet. And what would happen is a lot of people would run out to the store and then get a brand new computer and discover that it was 64-bit and they couldn't use it. This isn't as much of an issue now as it once was. But if you're really concerned, find out before you actually take the computer home, if you can.
One other point, though, which I'm sure you were going to mention, is if you do insist on putting a 32-bit version of an operating system onto a computer that was going to bundle with a 64-bit, be aware that, as Sean has already said, you can't see any more than 4 gig of RAM, so don't buy it, but don't bother buying 8.
Yeah, because then you're just wasting money. The two architectures that are used by CPUs to process data are x86, used by 32-bit operating systems, and x64, used by 64-bit operating systems. Now, I'm guessing x86 came from the 286, 386, 486 processors and stuff like that. I'm guessing that's where that number came from. Anyway, x86 uses a complex instruction set computer, or CISC, architecture to process multiple instructions with a single request. x86 processors use fewer registers than x64 processors. Registers are storage areas used by the CPU when performing calculations. x64 architecture is backward compatible with x86 and adds additional registers specifically for instructions that use a 64-bit address space. So the additional registers of the x64 architecture allow the computer to process much more complex instructions at a much higher rate. So you can still run 32-bit programs on a 64-bit processor and system, but when you actually are using 64-bit programs, it'll be optimized for them. As a technician, you may end up recommending an operating system for a customer or organization. You need to consider the budget and needs of a client and weigh the capabilities and limitations of the operating system and the hardware as well. There are two types of operating systems. These are desktop operating systems used in homes and small offices, and network operating systems used in larger corporations. A desktop OS has the following characteristics: supports a single user, runs single user applications, and shares files and folders on a smaller network with limited security. In the current software market, the most commonly used desktop operating systems fall into three groups: Microsoft Windows, Apple Mac OS, and Unix/Linux. So we're going to talk about these individually. Microsoft Windows is one of the most popular brands of operating systems used today. So let's name some popular Windows desktop operating systems.
Windows XP.
That's correct.
Windows 7.
And there's home and professional. Yep, there's Windows 7. What else do we have?
Windows 2000.
Yeah, well, Windows 2000 Professional was more, I don't really know how to describe it. It had some
network. More of a network operating system.
Yeah, it was, and it was kind of a mix between NT and 98, which made things very unusual. You don't see it as much anymore.
No, it wasn't a mix between NT and 98. It was based on the NT kernel with enhancements. There were no 98 bits in 2000. I ran it quite a bit.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking of ME, sorry. Complete and utter brain fail. And Millennium was fairly scary. So, yes, we've got Windows XP, XP Professional is used on computers that will connect to a Windows server on a network. Windows XP Home Edition used on home computers and has very limited security. Windows XP Media Center used on entertainment computers for viewing movies and listening to music. Windows XP Tablet PC Edition used for tablet PCs. Windows XP 64-bit Edition used for computers with 64-bit processors. Windows 2000 Professional was older Windows operating system that has been replaced by Windows XP Professional. Windows Vista Home Basic used on home computers for basic computing. Windows Vista Home Premium used on home computers to expand personal productivity and digital entertainment beyond the basics. Windows Vista Business used on small business computers for enhanced security and enhanced mobility technology. Windows Vista Ultimate used on computers to combine all the needs of both home and business users. And Windows 7 has different editions as well. Windows 7 Starter used on netbook computers to make networking easy. I don't really know if I like the networking made easy part. It's actually not bad, though. I use it here. Windows 7 Home Premium, used on home computers to easily share media. Windows 7 Professional, used on work computers to secure critical information and to make routine tasks easier to complete. Windows 7 Ultimate, used on computers to combine the ease of use of Windows 7 Home Premium with the business capabilities of Windows 7 Professional and provide added data security. One of the
I have one thing to say about
seven
this.
Editions. About which one?
About these versions of Windows 7. There's a table here in this part of the chapter, I believe. And you want to look at that because it's going to ask you questions about the different versions of Windows 7 in your Windows 7 exam. And that is a big one.
Yeah. One of the things that makes it a little bit easier for Windows 7 editions is that they are at least in theory, supposed to build successively on top of one another. So, in theory, Windows Premium is supposed to include all of the stuff that Starter does and more. Windows, you know, Business is supposed to include all of the stuff that Premium does and build onto it. Now, why I mention that is because in Vista and before, sometimes random features would just not appear. Like, in Business, the parental controls were gone. Just random things like that. I think they did a better job in 7 of trying to add on to the feature sets without taking stuff out. At least that's the impression I've gotten from what I've been reading in other sources. Okay, let me just skip that. Apple Mac is another brand. Is there something wrong?
Oh, she can't. She's not in the lecture theater. Yeah, you are. We can hear you. She hasn't moved back down into the lecture theater, so she couldn't hear anything. It's new user Ventrilo confusion.
Oh, yes. Okay. All right. Apple Mac is another brand of OS that is getting quite popular. One advantage for blind people is that it has its own built-in screen reader called VoiceOver. Apple computers are proprietary and use an operating system called Mac OS. Mac OS is designed to be a user-friendly GUI operating system. Current versions of Mac OS are now based on a customized version of Unix. Because of this, Mac OS also has a CLI, which is the terminal application. Guess what? That's pretty much all we see a little bit about Macs in Chapter 12, but that's pretty much it. This is a Windows course. We're going to move on to Unix now. Unix was introduced in the late 1960s, is one of the oldest operating systems. There are many different versions of Unix today. One of the most recent is the extremely popular Linux, L-I-N-U-X. This was developed by Linus Torvalds, I believe his name is pronounced, in 1991, and it is designed as an open-source operating system. Open source programs allow the source code to be distributed and changed by anyone as a free download or from developers at a much lower cost than other operating systems. A network operating system, or OS, has the following characteristics. This supports multiple users, runs multi-user applications, is robust and redundant, provides increased security compared to desktop operating systems. These are the most common network operating systems. Microsoft Windows network operating systems offered by Microsoft are Windows 2000 Server, Windows Server 2003, and Windows Server 2008. Windows Server operating systems use a central database called Active Directory to manage network resources. You'll probably never hear any more about Active Directory in ITE1, but there it is. Novell NetWare was the first OS to meet network OS requirements and enjoyed widespread development in PC-based local area networks LANs back in the 1980s. And actually, I think it was still around in the 90s for some time, too. Linux operating systems include Red Hat, Caldera, SUSE, Debian, Fedora, Ubuntu, and Slackware. So these have networking capabilities and network operating systems. Unix has various corporations offer proprietary operating systems based on Unix. Okay, now Grace would like to talk about Lab 5.2.2, which is the Network Operating System Jobs Lab. So take it away.
Okay, here we go. So this lab is actually not as hard as it looks. What you need to do is fill out the table for 3 network jobs. The things we need from you, in order of rows in the table, I believe, are the first row that is unlabeled is actually the organization that offers the certification that you want. And that isn't labeled for I don't know what reason. The next thing, I believe, is the what operating... Yes, it is. Next column is operating systems that it supports. Now, some of the network certifications will be something called vendor neutral, which means they don't support certain operating systems. The A-plus that you are studying for is vendor neutral. Well, actually, it's more Windows, but they call it a vendor-neutral certification because they are showing you hardware and software and trying not to go for any specific operating system such as Windows 7 or it's just basically neutral and general computer knowledge. So a couple of them, like CCNA, does Cisco, but NetPlus, the A-plus one, is vendor-neutral. The next thing you want is the certification name. And the last thing you want is courses that you would need to take to prepare for this certification. So 4 things, okay. Not too much. Go ahead.
Is this the one with the certifications or is this the one with the jobs? I can't remember.
Certifications and jobs. You get both.
Oh, okay. Yeah, they're both in there. Okay.
So you want 3 of them. Does anyone have any ideas of what certifications people might want to research?
Linux Plus.
Okay. Is that a network operating? I don't think that's a network operating system certification.
It is, because Linux is a network operating system.
Okay.
It's got network components in it.
Okay. Well, then that works. Anyone else?
Does anyone know what any of the other certifications are called?
Okay. Well, one you do not want to research, and you will actually be failed if you do research, because it is not a network operating system, is the A-plus certification. So, good certifications to look at are the Microsoft server certifications, because that is a network operating system one. CCNA is a good one to look at. CCENT is a good one. Novell has a certification still, I believe. Linux Plus, as Corey said. Any of those. So you'll need 3 of those to research. So there you go. That is...
Red Hat and those guys have their own too.
Oh, yeah, Red Hat.
Although those are obviously not vendor neutral.
Yeah, Ubuntu has
one
for sure.
That's what I ended up going with when I did this.
Okay.
So there's you some ideas there.
Absolutely. And that worksheet will be one of the ones due next week, The worksheet load picks up in Module 5, everybody.
It certainly does. Now, one of the things I want to talk about, because I don't think it actually was addressed here in the notes, is Windows X, you know, the Windows Home, XP Home, and Windows 7 Starter and that, they do not actually allow multiple users. Now, the reason I state this again is that fast user switching confuses people. What fast user switching allows you to do is keep one user logged in and have another user logged, you know, able to go in and use their stuff while keeping the other person's undisturbed. But that's still only one user at a time, because you can't have multiple users on other computers using the same using applications on it. Does that make sense? Because I know when I first read that, I did the same thing. I thought, but no, because I know I can hit switch user, and then, you know, Joe can get on and do this, but that's not the same as being multi-user. Okay, we're going to go on to making OS recommendations. To make an OS recommendation, you must review budget constraints, learn how the computer will be used, and determine which type of applications will be installed. When helping your customer choose an operating system, it is important that it is compatible with all applications a customer uses, and if it is on a network, it must be compatible with all computers on that network. Microsoft networks can have computers with many different Microsoft operating systems. Here are some things you should investigate when choosing an operating system. Does the computer have off-the-shelf applications or customized applications that were programmed specifically for this customer or their industry? If the customer will be using a customized application, the programmer of that application will specify which operating system is compatible with it. You'll hope that whoever wrote this program for you is somebody that you can actually reach and find this out from if you're not sure. Hopefully they haven't gone.
Yeah, sometimes these programmers
departed.
Or worse. Yeah, they may be gone.
Yeah, died.
Retired, dead. Yeah, this happens, and it really does happen that someone will have written a program 10 years ago for this organization, and they aren't alive anymore, and they were the only people who knew anything about this program.
Most off-the-shelf applications specify a list of compatible operating systems on the outside of the application package, box, or on their website. I'm sorry?
What about him? He's still around.
I didn't...
He doing jail?
No, that was Hans Reiser.
Oh, that's Hans. Hans. I always get the first names back up. I'm sorry,
oh,
you get
no,
the first
no, no,
names mixed up in there. You're right.
No. Kirk works for the University of Western Ontario and is still quite happy with his family. Hans Reiser, who did Reiser FS, killed his wife. Okay, we're just gonna get the right Reiser.
Wow.
Thanks. I've gotten those first names mixed up before. And other people have. Someone
sure
steered
what
me wrong.
Reiser FS is.
It's used by a fair number of, or some Linux OSs, it's their, or distros, it's their file system of choice, I guess. And I can't
it's no longer officially supported.
So, you should also be able to find information on what operating system a program supports on the web, since we kind of can't read the box easily. Are the applications programmed for a single user or multiple users? This information helps you decide whether to recommend a desktop OS or a network OS. If the computer will be connected to a network, make sure to recommend the same OS platform that the other computers on the network use, if you can. Are any data files shared with other computers, such as a laptop or home computer? To ensure compatibility of file formats, recommend the same OS platform that the other data file sharing computers use. As an example, your customer has a Windows network installed and wants to add more computers to the network. In this case, you should recommend a Windows OS for the new computers. If the customer does not have an existing computer equipment, does not have any existing computer equipment, the choice of available OS platforms increases. Make sure your customer's equipment meets the minimum hardware requirements for installing the chosen operating system. There is a great table in the notes that lists the minimum requirements for Windows operating systems. Check it out and become familiar with it if you're doing the A+, and this is testable to an extent, I think, in this exam, so look at it anyway. If the current equipment does not meet these requirements, you must do a cost-benefit analysis to decide if it would be better to upgrade a few components or buy new computers. Also, check the minimum hardware requirements for all applications that will be used, as they may be higher than for the OS. This will be true, like, for, you know, more and more nowadays if you're using Windows XP. An awesome application that you want to use will not work on XP and only works on Vista or 7. And this can happen sometimes, so be careful. Yeah.
You know the big one, and this makes people cry. Outlook Express doesn't run under Windows 7, everybody.
No.
Or Vista,
ouch,
for that matter. It's gone.
Bye-bye, Outlook Express. It's a pile. Say goodbye. It is a bloated application that works very well for blind people, that has horrific security problems that works very well for blind people, and incredible gaping holes in your system that works very well for blind people. Say goodbye.
Yeah, go do Thunderbird. Bye. It's really good.
Yeah, I didn't really think I would like it, but I use it for work, and I actually have a version that runs off a thumb drive, and it's really handy.
But even the
version
Windows
that
7...
doesn't run off the thumb drive is still handy. Windows 7 does not come with a mail client.
Oh, someone
nope.
said that it
you
did.
You get
okay.
nothing!
Vista does. Vista has its own, but 7 has not.
Yeah,
the one you can easily
get. You Windows Live Mail.
Yeah, if you go get one, you can get Windows Mail. Live Mail. It'll offer to install that for you, but it does not come with a mail client by default. It's one of those antitrust wobbles, so they took them all out. Sorry, Corey?
I just think that's kind of harsh in a way that this is a... that they weren't providing that, because a lot of OSs do throw in some sort of free mail client, whether it's theirs or somebody else's.
Oh, no, no, no. When you click on email under Windows 7, it goes, we don't currently have an email client on this system. Would you like Windows Live Mail? And you go, yes. And it goes, downloady, crunchy, crunchy, bang, bang, wibble, fizz. And it's there. Like, that's how easy it is.
Is Windows Live Mail pretty accessible-ish?
I have heard of people using it. People have used it.
Yeah, people do use it. They've got some scripts. I have to use it with my MSN because obviously Outlook Express doesn't support Hotmail or MSN addresses, so I have to use it for that reason. But in the sense, I do like, it's the structure is similar to Outlook Express, but it is doable.
Okay, well that's good to know. The next thing you're going to check to see if all existing hardware is compatible with the operating system. So that means that make sure your peripherals that you want to use, your printers, your scanners, your card readers, your whatever it is compatible. This next concept here is testable, and this is that most operating systems have a hardware compatibility list, or HCL. You can find this on the manufacturer's website. It contains a list of hardware that has been tested and known to work with the OS. If a component is not listed in the HCL, you may need to upgrade it. Not all HCLs are kept up to date, so you should check the website of the component manufacturer, because they may have updated drivers to make the component compatible with the new OS that the HCL doesn't know about. So there's a diagram 2 in this section that's very good that you should become familiar with in the final. It contains the paths where the OS and programs are installed, and this is also covered in chapter 12 as well. You want to know about this one. So things like the Windows OS is stored in C:\Windows, program files is in C:\Program files, stuff like that. Now we're going to talk about performing an install. Now this course does not talk about how to automate an install and do it very much. It does a little bit. But this course doesn't really explain how to do an unattended complete or fairly accessible install. Which is a pity, I think. And Carrie said that if we have time at the very end, depending on, you know, if we have any spare lecture time left, we may do a lecture on it. We've done a little bit of talk about it on some of the CaviCasts in the past, I think. But this course is assuming that you're going to get cited help to do that, at least for us, because they don't talk about this in some of the ways that we would need that are more helpful. So, unless there are any questions, we're going to talk about performing a clean installation of Windows. Okie dokie. A clean installation of Windows is where the previous program's data and settings on the main drive are removed. Perform a clean install in the following situations: when a computer is passed from one employee to another, when the operating system is corrupt, when a new replacement hard drive is installed in a computer. We'll talk in detail about what happens in a Windows installation from start to finish. The most common method of installation, installing an operating system is to use optical media such as a CD or a DVD. You can also install an operating systems from the local hard drive, over the network, or in the case of Windows 7, using a thumb drive. And we'll talk about the first two. Before you insert your optical media, make sure that the optical drive is set as the first boot device in the BIOS. This is important because otherwise you won't be able to boot from it. See Chapter 3 and the BIOS lab on how to do that. Or actually you'll need sighted help for your own BIOS. Before the actual installation of the operating system, the hard drive must be prepared. First, it must be partitioned, which means it is logically divided into one or more areas. Okay, here there are different types of partitions, and these can be a little difficult to understand, so you may need to reread this several times, and we'll talk about it in Chapter 12 as well. A primary partition is usually the first partition on a drive. Primary partitions cannot be subdivided, and you can have up to four per hard drive. The active partition is the partition used by the operating system to boot the computer. Only one primary partition can be marked active. So, you can have four primary partitions, but only one of them can actually boot the computer. An extended partition normally uses the remaining free space on a hard drive or takes the place of a primary partition. There can be only one extended partition per hard drive, and it can be subdivided into smaller sections called logical drives. A logical drive is a section of an extended partition that can be used to separate information for administrative purposes. To clarify, you can only have three primary partitions if you have an extended partition. That is a bit interesting. Next, the drive must be, and actually we'll play with partitioning in one of your Chapter 12 labs, and the virtual machine is a great idea for that one. Next, the drive must be formatted. When a hard drive is formatted, the partitions are prepared to hold files and applications. It is important to understand how a drive is divided to understand how formatting works. A sector is a physical space on the drive that contains a fixed number of bytes, generally at least 512. On newer drives, they're going to 4096 now, I believe. A cluster is also called a file allocation unit. It is the smallest unit of space used for storing data. It is a logical unit made up of one or more sectors. A track is one complete circle of data on one side of a hard drive platter. A track is broken into groups of sectors. A cylinder is a stack of tracks lined up one on top of another to form a cylinder shape. Drive mapping is the letter given to a physical or logical drive. For example, if you have two partitions on your hard drive, they might be mapped to C colon and D colon. Your optical drive may be E, and if you insert a thumb drive, that can map to F. Or if you're like my old if your computer's like my old computer and it's got two CD-ROM drives in. When you partition and format a hard drive, all data on it is lost. Remember that a clean installation of an operating system makes no effort to preserve data. That's something that can be hard for people to understand, and if you have to do a clean install on their computer, you need to be very, very, very clear to them about this, because some people, you say, yeah, I'm going to wipe the computer and reformat it, and they think, okay, yeah, I think they just figure it's some kind of jargon, and if they repeat it back, they'll make you happy. And then they get very sad when they can't get to their documents in their spreadsheet and stuff. And it's kind of like, yeah, I kind of tried to tell you that was going to happen. Backup stuff. We have CaviCasts on how to back up your data. The file system provides the directory structure that organizes users' operating systems, applications, configurations, and data files. So there are folders created for different purposes. Windows XP gives you a choice of two file systems. File allocation table 32, which is 32-bit, and it's known as FAT32 or FAT32. A file system that can support partitions up to 2 terabytes or 2,048 gigabytes. The FAT32 file system is supported by Windows 9X, Windows ME, Windows 2000, and Windows XP. Also, the Mac and Linux supported as well, I believe. Oh, yeah, I know the Mac does because I used a hard drive formatted that way. New Linux technology file does. System, NTFS, is a file system that can support partition sizes up to 16. I believe this is hexabytes.
Exabytes?
At least theoretically.
Exabytes.
Okay. I misunderstood JAWS when I heard that then, apparently. NTFS incorporates more file system security features and extended attributes than the FAT file system. If you're installing Vista or Windows 7, your file system will be NTFS. You don't get a choice. Now you can use other drives that are FAT32, but on Vista and 7, your Windows operating system itself is on NTFS, and that's all she wrote. That's all you get. If you do not create custom file partitions, Vista and Windows 7 automatically create one partition spanning the entire drive, and then this partition is formatted. Once automatic partitioning and formatting is complete, the operating system is then installed. In Windows XP, after the partitioning and formatting is done, the setup wizard starts installing an operating system using the default options, asks fewer questions, and the operating system is more likely to install correctly. This is because there is less chance of user error. You need to provide the following information for an installation using default options. Standards and formats that define currency and numerals. Text input language. Name of the user and company. Product key, which is not required for Vista or 7. You can put that in later, but on XP you must have it. Computer name. Administrator password. Date and time settings. Network settings. Domain or workgroup information. When the Windows XP installation disk first boots, you have three options. Press Enter to install Windows XP, press R to access the inaccessible recovery console, or Q to quit. If you choose Install Windows XP, the setup program checks to see if it is already installed on the hard drive. If it is, you will get the option to do a repair installation. This type of installation tries to fix a corrupt installation of Windows XP by replacing files in the current installation with files on the disk. This method is meant to preserve all data, programs, and settings, but you should back up anything important to separate physical media just in case. When you boot the Vista or 7 installation disks, you can upgrade the operating system. This allows you to upgrade Windows or repair an existing installation. Again, all data should be preserved, but back up just in case. This option will not appear if a previous installation is not detected. The second option is a custom, in parentheses, advanced install. This installs a clean copy of the OS, so no data is preserved. It allows you to choose where the OS will be installed and make changes to partitions. The third option is, of course, to quit. If you use the advanced options in Windows 7 and do not choose to do a clean install by reformatting the drive, the files from any previous installation will be moved to a folder called Windows_old that you can still access, so that you can still access your documents, for example. An administrator account called administrator is created when installing Windows. Make sure to change the name of this account as soon as possible. Attackers seek out this account because it is very powerful. Create a regular user account for everyday use to prevent yourself or others, or your customers, from making drastic changes that may cause breakage. Who does this? I don't think I did. Anyway, you want to make sure your administrator account...
You should.
I'm pretty sure my account is an administrator, but it may not be the administrator. How do you actually change it? I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, I was wondering that myself because...
It's in User Manager. It's easy. You just press F2 and you change the name. You go account name, F2, and you wipe out administrator and you put in custard pie or whatever you want to call the account. And it changes it just like that.
Okay, I don't think neat. I saw one called administrator. So I'll have to look again on these computers. But make
under
sure
7
your administrator account... Oh, under 7 is different. Okay. No, I think mine has my name on it or something. Make sure your administrator account is password protected. Very good thing to do. If you can. I certainly do, because I would prefer people not play around with things. Sometimes my Mac doesn't even have a monitor hooked up to it. And now after we make these choices, we're going to wait while Windows copies files to your hard drive, installs them, and reboots a few times. Once it is done, it will ask you to log in for the first time. You also get the fun of the Windows out-of-box experience. You can use Narrator to complete the step. I actually need to do that. I had someone available and chickened out and just had them read everything to me. And Grace said, why did you do that? Anyway, is anyone unfamiliar with Narrator? I hope most people know about it. If you don't, we'll briefly give a description. Anybody need that? Okay, I'm guessing
Everybody knows
either
you can
love
do
it
Windows Narrator to launch it, as well as pressing Windows U. You can just go Start Run Narrator, and up it comes.
Yeah, that is the easiest way to do it. Unfortunately, in Vista and 7, it's pretty sluggish and horrible, but it will get you through the out-of-box, apparently. The next step, if you are not evaluating Windows, is to activate it. To do this, you must have a connection to the internet, or you can call Microsoft and do it over the phone. To activate, go to Control Panel, System and Control Panel and the System option, and there will be an option to activate Windows. I know on XP it used to appear under Accessories in all programs too. I don't know about the newer ones. Activating allows you to download non-security patches and updates as well as receive Microsoft support. I never called Microsoft support. I don't know if I'd like to do that. But,
I have.
Okay.
No, it's fine. You ring them up, and it's actually the activation system is now completely automated, so you just key in the numbers and it gives you back what you need. But back when I actually did talk up and talk to a person, they're just like, why are you reactivating this copy of Windows, sir? And I said, because the computer that it was running on is now sitting in pieces and will no longer boot ever again. And he's like, thank you, sir, your activation code is blah. And it was that simple.
Okay, I just mean getting support for other things. I don't know how good that would be.
Yeah.
Now, if you don't activate security updates do actually happen, like the really, really, really important ones. But if you can, it's a good idea. It will make your life infinitely easier if you can.
Now, as far as I know, there's some history behind that. Apparently, Microsoft were going to block all updates from anybody who had a pirated copy of Windows. Like, if you were non-genuine or non-activated,
they did for a while.
But they jumped up and down. SANS jumped up and down, and a whole lot of government people jumped up and down and said, this is too dangerous. If you deny everybody these security updates, you are opening up thousands of people to act as botnets and all that sort of stuff. So we need to provide security updates. So Microsoft relented and will let you have any updates that are marked critical. If you do not activate. But you don't get Media Player 11, and you don't get all the updates for Office, and you don't get all the non-critical ones unless you are legit.
Quite a few of them are. Quite a few of them are security related, and they don't say critical though. So, or do you mean important? Well, I guess doesn't really.
No, it doesn't really matter. There are ones that are tagged critical and that are actually tagged critical.
Must have by everybody.
And they are security. The actual security ones you get.
Okay. After installation, you will probably have updates that need to be installed. You almost certainly will. These could be security and stability updates, as well as drivers. If anyone is unfamiliar how to check for updates, I hope most people are, but you have a lab where you get to do this, or if you already know, you get to pretend to again. But checking for updates is important, and it's slightly different depending on your version of Windows, so you need to do that. If you're unfamiliar how to do this with any OS, review your labs and notes. After patches and service packs are installed, go to Device Manager and verify that all hardware is installed and working properly. If you're not familiar with how to do this in any OS, see your labs and notes for how to get to Device Manager specifically. Okay, what does a yellow exclamation point mean in Device Manager if it's next to an item in a circle? What does it mean?
Error.
What type?
You're right.
Sorry. It does mean that there's an error. You're right. I was thinking of something else. It means that there's a general error with the device. How about a red X in a circle? What does that mean? Somebody other than Bert, because you already did one.
That it's disabled. It's
not going to work at all.
Melissa is right. It is because the device has been disabled, usually by you. What about a yellow?
No, I've seen them disabled by Windows. I've actually seen Windows disable them.
Oh, really?
Yes, I had a USB to serial and I plugged it in, and it Windows actually disabled. And then I pulled the properties and they said, "This device has been disabled due to incompatibility. You will need to update the drivers before this device will start. Once the update is complete, please manually start the device." So Windows can disable them for you. If it
wow, I've never seen that. That's interesting. Okay, yellow question mark in a circle, what does that mean?
It means the system is missing a device driver.
Yes, it does. It actually means it can't really can't tell what it is. It doesn't know what the device actually is, and it has no driver for it. You're right. To expand items in the Device Manager tree view, press the right arrow key. If you believe a device is not working properly, press your Applications key and choose Properties. You will find a read-only edit box that will tell you the status of the device. The notes explain how to use Device Manager with a mouse. And that's important because you may need sighted people to tell you. Basically, if a item is collapsed, there's going to be a plus sign you click, and it will come open. And you can still do the properties the same way, but I don't know. Most sighted people seem to kind of get the idea if you say, "Hey, I need you to open these and tell me if anything has icons next to them." So we do all of this for one computer.
With my mother.
Okay,
how do I open
enough.
Them,
Dale? Most of the sighted people
I've
worked
with. What do I click on to
with?
Open them? You're lucky. No. Seriously, if you go to somebody who's never used computers before, this will really test you because they don't know what all the little icons do and mean and how they work, and you have to explain them. So just watch out for that, because if you are doing really simplistic users on a help desk, you will need to know how this stuff is driven.
And that's a really hard one for us to do. We get really sucked into how do we do it with JAWS and the keyboard and that kind of thing. And I suppose you could sort of tell someone how to do it with a keyboard, down arrow, right arrow, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah,
but
I have that issue
one.
All the time because my in-laws come over and they need to get online to use the bank or they'll... Because I have a screen, I have a theme, an ocean theme on my computer, and instead of supposedly a hand, when they're on the internet, they see this fin, like from a whale or a fish, and they're like, how do I make this fin do this, or how do I click on da-da-da, and they'll point at a spot in the screen, and I'll be like, I'm not sure.
How
do I
click
on this
to
make it
bigger? I've never seen that.
You know?
You can probably
yeah, that can be really frustrating.
Well,
yeah, you
yeah,
might
but,
set that
like,
theme to standard, just to...
And then you can,
yeah,
and then you can have
will.
The sounds, and then get rid of the pitches, so you can still have from a dolphin, but still have, like, normal pitches.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
I,
that
I
is possible.
Switched it, I switched to thinking it would be unique, and, you know, because I just thought it would be cool, because I like the ocean stuff, but it is
yeah,
confusing
you
them, so I think I might want to just switch it back, and, but... They would always tell me, how do I click on this to make it bigger? Or how do I click on this? And I'll be like, well, what are you talking about? Because what I usually do is I shut down JAWS for them because they hate it. They hate JAWS.
Well, yeah,
with a
you'll
passion,
need to do
so.
That. I'll tell you what
and
you
then
can
be like,
do. What you can do, if you're really serious about learning how these things look, and it won't help for every instance. There is a book that National Braille Press sells that has tactile diagrams that show you the minimize and maximize and close buttons and how the Windows Explorer is laid out in 7 and Vista. And it's really cool. So,
okay, what about XP?
That's something people might
look
at.
That's what I have.
They may have for XP, but I know they've got it for Vista.
I think
7.
That one's out of public, out of print. But
ah, crud.
It might be.
Check with them,
Matt,
I'll tell you.
Upgrading. Yeah.
Yeah.
I will check with them.
Okay. So we do all of this stuff for one computer, and that's good. But what if you have 100 computers? You don't want to do all of this steps for all 100 of them. You want to minimize this as much as you can. So installing and configuring that many computers would take forever, like I've said. So Microsoft has several solutions that we'll talk about. Microsoft created SysPrep to alleviate this, and this is just one way that we'll do it. And in Chapter 12, they cover some more. SysPrep prepares an operating system that will be used on computers with different hardware configurations. With SysPrep and a disk cloning application, technicians are able to quickly install an operating system, complete the last configuration steps for the OS setup, and install applications. Here are the steps to perform a disk clone and use SysPrep. Create a master installation on one computer. This master installation includes the operating system, software applications, and configuration settings that will be used by the other computers in the organization. Run SysPrep. After that, you create a disk image of the configured computer using a third-party disk cloning program. Copy the disk image onto a server. When the destination computer is booted, a shortened version of the Windows Setup program runs. The setup creates a new System Security Identifier, SID, installs drivers for hardware, creates user accounts, and configures network settings to finish the OS install. That sounds pretty cool. We also have network installation. Windows can also be installed over a network. To install Windows XP, first prepare the computer by creating a FAT or FAT32 partition of at least 1.5 gigabytes. You must also make the partition bootable and include a network client. You can also use a boot disk that contains a network client so that the computer can connect to a file server over the network. Copy the Windows XP installation files, the i386 folder from the installation disk, to the network server and make sure to share the directory so that clients can connect and use the files. Boot the computer and connect to the shared directory. From the shared directory, run the setup program, which in XP is called winnt.exe. The setup program copies all of the installation files from the network share onto your hard drive. After the installation files have been copied, the installation continues much the same way as if the installation were performed from a CD or disk. To install Windows 7 over the network, you must create a FAT32 partition of over 5 gigabytes, and when it comes time to run the setup program, it will run setup.exe, which is found in the source directory. And you would still need to have a network client and all that, I'm thinking, in order to do this. Any questions? I hope I'm not confusing you guys. You guys are awfully quiet this time.
This is just lots and lots of unconnected guff to anything else you've ever heard. So I would say people
it
are
is
spotty. Yeah, and there's okay. No linkage. That's the problem with
and
this.
There's no linkage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just there's
basically
nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, it's basically operating system fun. We can end, because if we don't end, we'll finish before we actually should. So if people are done, we can be done.
We'll keep if we could keep going. I think we still have some time.
Yeah, I know.
It's up to everyone else.
This is going to be finished if you keep going. We're going to finish today, which we don't actually want to do.
That is true.
So we can stop.
Let's see where I'm at. Ah, come on, Brailsense. Yeah, I am halfway through. So,
excuse me. I am kind of mush-headed about these network install things. I mean, I read the whole chapter.
Okay,
this
let me summarize.
It was a little chaotic.
This is easy.
Yeah,
this is easy.
Because I've never
Here
done
we go.
This.
Right. You get a network client, like the DOS network client that's freely available from Microsoft, and you set it up, and you net use a drive across onto your network server, okay? So you net use /\burtpower/netinst. And then from burtpower/netinst, you run winnt.exe, and it copies all of the files down onto the computer and then runs the install from the computer. That's all the network install does. It's that simple. The hard bit is getting the network clients running so you can connect to the network server. So that's all a network install is here. We copy all of the files off the network server temporarily down onto a blank partition on the hard drive, then run the setup program like we could have normally. Or we get somebody to insert a CD and copy all the files down. It's just different. It just isn't done from the network. So there's no voodoo stuff in here.
It doesn't really explain that as well as it could, I think. It does kind of make that sound mysterious and whoa. Okay, so who would like to break off for now? Because we've covered quite a bit today.
I'd like to break off. My mind's getting pretty full.
Okay.
Figures. Cool. We never get through this much in this lecture. We have not ever done that, so I think that it'd be a good breaking point.
Yeah, my mind is so cool. I will put some...
So, I think we're going to give you guys labs 5.2.2 to do, 5.3.2 to do, and 5.4.8 to do. If you want help with 5.4.8, there was a study session done last term that was really good. You were not doing the part about the registry. I had people do that last term, and
unfortunately, because of everybody uses NVDA in this class, it's almost impossible. You basically can't do it with NVDA. You have to use JAWS. But if you are wanting to do the registry part, because it is really cool, and you are on Windows 7, you can use column and row headers to do it. There's instructions on that in the accessibility document. If you are working on XP, you need to get a hold of me and get the registry keys that you'll need to use to do that part of the lab. They won't hurt you. All they'll do is change the color of your desktop.
They're on the website.
Oh, are they? Okay.
In with the study group, I'm pretty sure I've got pre-configured blue, red, and whatever .reg.
Okay, cool.
I'll double check.
Yeah, there's blue and red there.
Yep, those portions are not required.
Would you guys mind sending a task list in case we get a little forgetful?
Of course, we're always going to send task lists. I'm just telling you now.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Some people don't read task lists, some people don't listen. We need to cater for both groups.
I always read the test.
Well, I believe in wearing belt and suspenders, too.
Yes, okay. You will, of course, always get a task list. So that's the three you're going to do. Two research labs. This group of labs is going to take you some time, more time than you've actually spent on many of your labs in the past. So you've got two pretty serious research labs and the 548. And the only reason I'm stopping today is because I definitely don't want you to have to do the rest of the labs all in 1 week.
No. That's too evil, and we don't want to do that. As we said before, and this is especially true if you really want to do the registry stuff, virtual machine, you can break it as much as you want. We don't care, really. You just keep the archives, as I said at the beginning, and if you really trash the virtual machine, you just unzip it, and you have a new one again. That's really, really good for these. I actually ended up having to get one because I have XP Home on my desktop, and I couldn't do the backup lab. And I was like, oh, crud, I need professional. Okay, let's go virtual machine.
Okay, question about the virtual machines.
Melissa, not you.
Password.
Okay, you need to email me, and I will email Cavi or IT instructors, and we will email you that so that you have it forever, and so it isn't put out on a recording.
No, it's on all the exploration recordings. Fair. It's VMware and machines with a capital M. There you are, VMware. And machines with a capital M is the password, okay? Because it's on the exploration recording.
Ah, fair.
If your hardware isn't compatible with it, and we talk about that in the CaviCast, then it won't. You will not be able to do it. But if you have the power to do it, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, Melissa, you won't be able to because you've told me about your hardware that you've got, and that won't be possible, unfortunately, for you.
You need at least a gig of RAM, and you need
And I've only got 10 to 20.
Ew. Okay. Can we have an I'm sorry party for Melissa?
That won't work.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay, gig of RAM and about 10 to 20 gig of disk space for the virtual machines is good. If you've got less than that, your mileage may vary, limit of one per customer. If it breaks, you keep both pieces, no user serviceable parts inside.
And if you're on a netbook, don't either.
It works. I've done it.
You can.
Okay.
I've done it, yeah. It on an Asus netbook, it is, under 7 it would be less of a problem. If you've got 2 gig of RAM, it is unfortunately slow, but it does work. And you can boot the virtual machines.
Especially on your netbook, Sean, you've got a dual core.
Actually, yeah that fine. Probably would work okay on here. I was doing it on my Mac, which is an adventure in and of itself.
You can boot our virtual machines on the Mac. You need to import them into Fusion, and you work it out. We
Fusion
don't
is not
officially
free,
support it.
So.
No, Fusion is $75. But there is a 30-day trial. We should mention the 30-day trials you can get. No, that's cheap. Like, VMware Workstation
is
$300.
Really is.
Yeah, like, do you want to pay $300 or $75?
You guys have the free player software right now, and that's up there, and it's free for you to use. And
that's
basically
pretty good for what you
need. Yeah, and it does what you need it to do.
And we have an HTML document that explains in very good, very minute detail how to set it up and use it, as well as our CaviCast. If you ask a question that is covered in that document, we will refer you back to that document. Not because we don't like you, but because we think you should read it.
I've done this to people who are my good friends and referred them back to the document before. And it's somebody actually got very offended by me doing this, and I'm like, no, it's nothing personal. It really isn't. But you have to read the document.
But sometimes holding your hand all the time is not going to help you.
Well, no, the other time is somebody rang me up and they're like, what's the password? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, just give me the password. I'm like, just look up the document. That's what I do. And they're like, oh. I said, I don't remember the passwords. I don't have mental space for that. I just look up the file. That's why it's there.
To go back to an old adage, it's the difference between catching a fish and teaching me to fish.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And if we do, it really isn't that we don't like you. It isn't that we're not your friends. It's honestly that everybody gets sent back to that document. So there's no need to block your instructor on Skype or MSN. It's really not that about you.
Another document that will become more relevant for you from this point on is the lab accessibility document. This will tell you if there are any labs that are not required, if there are any labs that have bits that aren't doable because of accessibility issues. This is another document which we may refer you back to. Grace spent a lot of time updating this and writing it, and it's very useful. So please have a look at that as well as you do the different chapters from Module 5 on out.
And if you want to know where it is, it's
in
every zip file.
In the zips. It's
and in the folders.
Yes, it's all over the place.